The Guardian.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week we meet Dr. Sigmund Freud in his new reincarnation by Viggo Mortensen. A Dangerous Method sees Viggo team up with Keira Knightley and Michael Fassbender under the watchful eye of director David Cronenberg. I go to meet Viggo. Plus, we talk to the director of The Woman in Black, James Watkins, about his new adaptation of the Susan Hill novel, starring Daniel Radcliffe. Guardian critic Zam Brooks is here as we review A Dangerous Method and The Woman in Black, but we also take a look at The Muppets and The Vow. Lie down on the couch and close your eyes. It's Film Weekly.
Need man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny.
A Dangerous Method is David Cronenberg's adaptation of Christopher Hampton's stage play, The Talking Cure. Set on the eve of the First World War, it focuses on the relationship between the psychiatrist Carl Jung and the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud. It stars Viggo Mortensen as Freud in his third successive collaboration with Cronenberg after History of Violence and Eastern Promises. Michael Fassbender plays Carl Jung and Keira Knightley plays Sabina Spielrein, the beautiful but disturbed woman who comes between the two men.
I don't think you have any notion of the true strengths and depths of the opposition to our work. There's the whole medical establishment, of course, baying to send Freud to the auto da fe. But that's just nothing compared to what happens when our ideas begin to trickle through in whatever garbled form they're relayed to the public. The denials, the frenzy, the incoherent rage.
But might that not be caused by your insistence in the exclusively sexual interpretation of the clinical material?
All I'm doing is pointing out what experience indicates to me must be the truth. And I can assure you that in 100 years' time, our work will still be rejected.
I've come to a quiet street in Hampstead, North London. It was in this house that Sigmund Freud spent the last year of his life. He moved here on the 27th of September 1938, a refugee from the Nazis, his books and those of his fellow psychoanalysts having been publicly burned in Germany in 1933. He moved here from Vienna, of course, in Austria, and he's exactly replicated that study from the Bergergasse in Vienna here in Maresfield Gardens, Hampstead. For the last 16 years of his life, although he suffered from cancer, he continued to work. And in England, he began his final unfinished work, Outline of Psychoanalysis, and in addition, Freud maintained his practice and received a number of patients for analysis at Maresfield Gardens. So I knock on the door now. Ah, Dr. Freud, your 215 is here. In fact, it's not Dr. Freud. It's a very good impersonation of Dr. Freud by Viggo Mortensen, who's sitting in Freud's study. I mean, this is extraordinary because not only is it odd for you having played Freud, but it's also an exact replica of the Bergergasse, as much as they could do here, which is almost a replica of what the study that David Cronenberg designed for you in the film as well, I think.
Well, it's actually his, where he took all of his books and a lot of his artifacts, you know, in the Bergergasse and Vienna. They didn't leave much of anything behind. There's a lot of photos and things, but this is where all the things that were in there. I mean, it's not really a replica of the place, the space, but it's the things that were in there. Feels sort of transgressive to be here, but I guess Freud was all about transgression to some degree. So,
I mean, we're surrounded by artifacts, as you mentioned. There seem to be sort of ancient kind of bowls and statues, figurines. Some of them sexual, some of them not. Are these tools familiar to you from your research for the A Dangerous Method?
The penises are quite familiar. And as plentiful as I remembered.
Well, it was behind you. You can't see it, but the couch is behind you, Viggo, which is covered in the same kind of Baroque rug that the one in your film is.
It's a little spooky being in here, I must say. Seeing the chair. I have to say that our movie did a very good job. I know that David's team took a lot of care with not only Freud's you know, living and working spaces, but also with Jung's. They had blueprints for the house, they had blueprints for the office, so it was a very, very close approximation, I would say.
Because what's interesting to me about the film, and relief in some ways, that you don't do the Dr. Freud like this, no. That everyone does for comedy accents.
No, I mean, we did an English. English stood in for German, so there was no reason to do an accent. And in fact, he spoke very, very good high German. He wrote beautifully.
There's a little pair of pince-nez round glasses there that must be pretty spooky. We don't know for sure, but, you know, they adorned the nose of the great man.
They probably did. I'm loath to touch any of these things. It feels like it would be wrong, but I like looking at... there's a print of Dr. Charcot on the wall, mm-hmm. Someone he went and studied with in Paris.
The more you studied him, Vigo, to play him, the more you learned about him... clearly, but the more you were fascinated by him, or the more you admired him?
The more I admired him, I thought he was just the range of his interests. I thought as controversial as he still is for some people, and as much as people think that he was, you know, transgressive and revolutionary, which he was, he was very much a gentleman, very discreet, and in a sense, there was an essential modesty about him, I think. And generosity in terms of sharing his ideas, in terms of giving others a voice, mm-hmm. being inclusive, you know, in his conversations and his research. But he was not someone that took well to being contradicted or confronted. You know, he could be very, that wit that was so enjoyable and lovely and a great advantage to him in conversations and lectures, that irony could turn... very cutting and even cruel, mm-hmm. if he felt it was necessary, right. To defend himself or his ideas.
All that's in your performance. It turns to, by turns, it's Quicksilver and then pompous and then affronted and all of those things. There's a lot, obviously, Freud that you've either knew beforehand or have accrued through playing him. Now, you don't do this for all your characters, but not all of your characters have such chronicled and rich real histories, I suppose. But if they do have one, do you often go into it as detailed?
Yeah, always. I mean... to some degree, it's probably out of insecurity, wedded with certain habit. You know, I just feel like leaving no stone unturned is a good idea. You never know what might come in handy. You can read dozens and dozens of books, go to many places, look at many objects, read many accounts of a person's life, say in the case of Freud, where there's quite a bit available from contemporaries, descriptions of him, the way he spoke, the way he stood, the tenor of his voice, his ironic tone, all those things. You can look at many things, and all of a sudden it's one unexpected phrase, one image, one particular way of holding the cigar, let's say, that he had that seemed consistent, that seemed right, you know, that can unlock something. You never know where it's going to come from, and the more you look, the more chances that you'll find something useful. You don't have to do that. You can just learn your lines and read the script many, many times. I know a lot of actors just simply do that and prepare gesture to gesture, intonation, everything, and repeat it just by rote. And that works for them because they have the technical ability. They have a finely tuned personal instrument. You know, they can speak well. They can do things well. You know, whatever works is I think, many ways of skinning a cat, as they say. And David Cronenberg is also someone who does a lot of research, and it's one of the reasons I enjoy working with him, because we do share that.
Strangely enough, I thought that, much as I loved A Dangerous Method, The History of Violence was perhaps the more Freudian of David Cronenberg's works, in a way.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true. Tom Stahl could probably, well, Joey could probably use a good talking session or two or many more. I don't know. It would be an interesting patient.
Well, you've been, as ever, a very interesting interviewee, one that walked around a lot, but nevertheless, it's all right. It's nice to see someone actually kind of taken by the research and being let into this. Is a place you couldn't even come into this bit.
No. So I came, there was a rope right about here, I think you could come this far, and that was it. Yeah. I'm going to have to take one more walk around.
Now off you go. I'm going to say goodbye. No, I don't know. Well, you might not be allowed to. He's touching the couch. He's going to have some Freud on his fingers. Vigo, bye. That was Viggo Mortensen at the Freud Museum in London with me. And joining me now to review A Dangerous Method, among others, is the Carl Jung of film criticism, none other than Zan Brooks.
I think I'm more than Neil Jung.
Yeah, I think you're
perfect. But here I am.
Anyway. Forever Jung. We saw this in Venice, did we not?
Yes, we did, premiere.
I admired its crispness back
then.
Oh,
did you now? Yes. You admired the crispness?
Yeah, I think it was one of those very ordered kind of films that Cronenberg sort of shoots with a surgical precision. I've always thought that about him, especially something like Dead Ringers, obviously. But he has this clear kind of vision that I think his films are sort of uncluttered, almost to the point of stagey, stylized in a way.
Yeah, I think you're making quite a good case for it. I think that it is probably crisp and uncluttered and formal. And there's something reassuring about that, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, the early days of psychoanalysis and sex and spanking and people who are kind of screwed up.
You need it uncluttered.
Yeah, and you really don't. You don't want the mess. Let's keep it as above board as possible. And it's very well acted. I have kind of come around to Keira Knightley's performance in it, which I think I was a little bit alarmed and unnerved by.
Yeah, well, I think it's what she does in it.
It is what she does.
She juts that chin out.
I mean, you know, it's wildly over the top, but then she's a psychiatric patient.
Yeah.
So what on earth else is she going to be? She's a hysteric, Viggo Mortensen is great as Freud.
You think so?
I think he was really good.
Yeah,
it's an unshowy performance.
You didn't think, no.
That drives me crazy, the sort of the de rigueur European accent. But I thought it was a very subtle, nuanced, unshowy performance. And he plays Freud as this, you know, kind of watchful, slightly lizard-like character sitting behind the desk.
Not always lovable.
Cold, I guess.
I don't think anyone ever thought Freud was lovable, really.
No, not really.
Clement
Maybe Mrs.
Freud was sort of lovable.
Clement Freud was good with his wine, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was the kind of the louche Freud.
Yeah. Matthew Freud.
I don't know.
Less so.
Emma Freud.
Lovely.
But not the granddaddy.
No.
And Fassbender very good as Jung. And Fassbender's just in everything at the moment. So it's very well acted. If I had a slight problem with it, it almost felt too handsome and well upholstered and heavy. And it felt at times like a bit of kind of masterpiece theatre. Like,
yeah.
I wish that it had a bit of wildness and a bit of kind of turbulence.
Well,
in
Vincent Cassel, or Vincent
he's very
Cassel,
good
he's
as
supposed
Otto,
to be the wild,
the degenerates,
wild
but he's only in it for like 10 minutes.
I know,
something.
And he gets a bit of star business. I've seen interviews that he's done for this film, and I'm like, you're hardly in it, mate.
Yeah.
But he is the wild and kind of the
sort
spice,
of
sexual mania in there.
Yeah, I could have done with a little bit more of him.
Yeah.
And possibly a little bit more spanking.
Yes.
I think that you needed something to knock a bit of life into the film.
But let's talk about Keira, because you mentioned her. I mean, people don't like Keira Knightley always. I've always been a fan. I've always thought she's a
star. I think
she
can be very good.
She can be. And I thought she was very brave here with that jutting out chin madness thing. And really threatening us with it and kind of going, oh, my God, I mean, you really are giving that power. And then she brings it back. And by the end, it's kind of in kind of repose. And she looks beautiful and serene.
There's a narrative to this performance, and I think she deserves some credit for that. And she starts in sort of sixth gear and risks blowing out the circuits because of that everyone's like, oh my word, there she is screaming in the back of the carriage and thrusting her chin out, and it looks like this terrible kind of hammy bit of Oscar bait, but it is a performance that develops, and what it develops is actually it kind of winds down and she becomes more and more restrained. So having initially giggled at this performance, I actually think she's good in it and is worthy of being alongside Fassbender and Mortensen.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those films that people see, and I've kind of monitored people's reactions to it. It is quite talky, as you said, it is quite stagey. It's based on The Talking Cure, a stage play in the first place.
Yeah,
Christopher Hampton.
But I think was based on a book, so it has a very kind of heavyweight literary pedigree.
And which in turn was based on the actual transcription of the papers that they found in Jung or Freud's letters.
And which in turn is based on all of us muddling our way through life with all of our urges.
It is. Well, I'm afraid, I think it gets there as well. I mean, it's interesting from Cronenberg, isn't it? Now it's kind of the man of body horror goes beneath that even.
Beneath that, I do look to him for a bit of wildness and strangeness. And this story should provide it in spades, and I felt that he was slightly handling it with sort of surgical gloves on. But for all that, it's a film of great interest, and it's a film that sort of stayed with me, and I think it is a talking
I enjoyed
point.
Listening to it, and the ideas that were batted back and forth.
Yes, and it's rare to see a film that is about ideas and about different stances and about the arguments that you have and which approach works best. Because of that, I would actually recommend it. Not wholeheartedly, but I would.
Yeah, I do. I think it's good to ponder these things. Sam, we're also going to look this week at The Woman in Black. We're going to look also at The Muppets, who are back, and we'll look at the film called The Vow. I think we should start with The Vow.
Meatloaf.
You do not like this song.
Anything for love.
You have to turn it off.
But I won't do that.
Please stop.
Life's all about moments of impact and how they change our lives forever.
Now, as you can tell from this, this is a rom-com? It's neither romantic nor comic.
I don't know. Yeah, what on earth is it?
Is
it's a bit confused,
is
isn't it? It's Rachel McAdams as Paige, who she's happily married, but then she's involved in a car crash while she's listening to Meatloaf. A truck piles into the back of her, which I think is probably a warning for anybody not to listen to Meatloaf.
Well, she's listening to Channing Tatum, her husband, singing Meatloaf
as well, which is sort of a double whammy. And then the triple whammy of the car going into the back of her, after which she is plunged into a 5-year coma. Fortunately, we don't follow that in real time. Then she comes out of that and can't remember that she is married. And her last memory is of her fiancé, her ex-fiancé, played by Scott Speedman, who she thinks she's still in love with. And the dilemma here is for Channing Tatum playing the husband, who says, I need to make my wife fall in love with me again.
Yeah, which he does by wearing lots of knitwear.
He does, yeah, that always works.
Yeah, that's why I'm wearing one today. It's a chunky bit of cardigan.
It's working for me.
See, you're straight back at. So she goes back to her parents, who are played by Jessica Lange, yeah. Who looks herself like
Jessica
she's
Lange's
had several...
Jessica Lange's kind of okay in this.
Really?
Well, you know,
she's been through quite a few windscreens herself and been repaired to me. And Sam Neill. I like Sam Neill.
Do you know? It looks like Jeffrey Archer. I've never quite been able to get over that.
I was confused.
Yeah. I'd like to see Jeffrey Archer in this
role. Sam Neill sort of has been the same age for about 40 years.
He has, hasn't he? He has.
Do you think he made a pact with the devil in Damien?
I don't think he's quite real.
No,
I think they put him
not.
In the box.
What they do in Australia. And I always forget he's Australian as well.
Yeah.
That's very much by
That's
the by.
Very by
but
the by.
I did find myself thinking
well,
that
this
all
is the
way
thing.
Through the film.
You're reaching for anything to distract you, aren't you? Is Sam Neill Australian? Yes, he is. And you can ponder that for like 10 minutes while this film's going on. And that way you manage to survive it. It's like, I mean, it's one of those weird things that it's a film about recuperating from a serious brain injury. And yet the film itself looks like it's recuperating from a serious brain injury. It's a bit simple, it's a bit slow, it's easily spooked, and it likes just kind of sitting down quietly in knitwear. And so you almost want to just sort of tiptoe around it.
Yeah, it's one of those films where you kind of, which it's so obvious that you kind of wish that you could forget that you've seen this film. I wish I could go through a windscreen and I would then erase
don't
all
wish
memory.
It, Jason.
You might come, you careful what you wish for. I mean, I don't like rom-coms when they're bad at all, you know, the 27 yeah. Dresses chick flick kind
yeah.
of stuff.
But
and
this
is obviously
that,
for chicks
is
because Channing Tatum's the one who gets his, yeah. his chest out and his bum out.
Yeah.
But what is this film? It is quite extraordinary. This
well,
film.
I can only
it may be. I think it is the worst film I've ever seen.
I mean, I can only conclude that it's one of these films that started off as one thing, then was turned into something else in one script meeting, turned into something else in the other. And in the end, you have got the film that's just come through the windscreen. A total mess. Basically, you know, on the verge of total idiocy.
Yeah. I mean it's directed by someone called Michael Suggsy.
Yeah.
But I think
Suggsy.
Suggsy or Suggsy.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I hate it. I mean, from the first minute of Channing Tatum's voiceover,
yeah.
we had his theory about things bumping into each other. You just think, Channing Tatum doing a voiceover, a theory about life, it's just not going to work for me. The Vow.
Stick with Freud.
Yes, let's stick with Freud, indeed. Let's go to The Woman in Black, Zan, because we're going to hear from my guest, James Watkins, a little bit later, but he has returned with his second film. It stars Daniel Radcliffe, and unless you've had your head down a hole, you will know that he is no longer Harry Potter. He is instead a Victorian ghost hunter. Daniel Radcliffe. Well, he's not a ghost hunter. He's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer.
But
he's an unwilling ghost hunter,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes,
he's
well.
Called to Eel Marsh House, which is the obligatory, the old dark place.
Spooky place.
Yeah, spooky place.
It is a spooky place.
It is a very spooky place, and when the tide's in, you can't actually reach it. And
it's
thinks,
one of those Scooby-Doo places you just...
Oh, it's a total Scooby-Doo
just
thing.
Just don't go there,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, it's total Scooby-Doo. It's got the, you know, every chandelier is covered with cobwebs.
Yeah.
The crows are going... In the garden outside.
You did crow very well.
Very good. Yeah, well, I was a crow
in
previous life.
You were Brandon Lee. You replaced him.
And every window has a face popping up in it. There's a footstep on every stair.
Yeah.
And it's all the cliches, basically. Yeah. I'm still not convinced by Daniel Radcliffe as an actor, having endured 8 Harry Potter films and now this. I mean, he's perfectly serviceable in this, but James Watkins does a great shock. You know, this is a great spring-loaded film full of, of bumps in the night. And I was absolutely levitating from my seat at various times during this film. While on screen, Daniel Radcliffe is kind of walking around with a slightly sort of pensive air of confusion.
Yeah, but it doesn't make... he's been a wizard for, like,
his
years.
His hair would go white. None of this stuff scares him.
He's used to all this bumps in the night and magic.
Maybe so. Maybe he's just, like, jaded and listless.
Yeah. And he's got loads of money as well. He's like, I don't need this. But I thought this was really good, actually.
I kind of enjoyed it.
In the hobbledy-hoy kind of coachman stuff.
Yeah, it's got the rustics who've all got secrets. And they're, like, sort of out of American Werewolf in London, aren't they? Brilliant. And then Kieran Hines popping up to do the exposition to sort of explain things. Although, I mean, I have read the book, the Susan Hill book.
Oh, have you? Well done.
Yeah, I do always try and do my homework on these things, as we've established many times.
And I don't.
And you don't. And it's very different. I think it's scripted by Jane Goldman, and she's basically kind of removed most of the plot and just thought, let's have more faces in windows, which is fine. But it does make it look... It's like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean being based on the Disneyland ride, and this is like based on either Scooby-Doo or a ghost train.
It's a Hammer film. So it is a Hammer film, back. And it has kind of got that kind of old kind of Victorian Gothic Ingrid Pitt kind of one. Unfortunately, it doesn't have Ingrid Pitt.
Or Christopher Lee.
Well, the old Ingrid Pitt. I don't want to see the current one. It had all those kind of, you know, kind of Victorian Gothic. And I kind of thought that, well, it was nice after all that Spanish horror that we've had.
To see
the English. It really suits England, I think, Gothic horror.
It does, but it's not fusty. It's certainly been modernised for the kids, hasn't it? So it is like the others on steroids and amyl nitrate.
Yeah.
So it's just every single second there's something erupting out of the corner of the room.
But it's about kids being taken as well by the woman in black.
It's ostensibly about that, isn't it? It's ostensibly about, as these ghost stories always are, the pain of the past and the revenge and the wronged woman and the class system and blah, 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 blah. But really, it's about watching little Harry Potter being chased by ghouls.
Yeah, which he does, I think, quite well.
Well, he does it stoically.
Yeah, doesn't he? We don't want too much more from him than that. Talking of which, the Muppets. Yes, they're back, Zan. It's time to put on makeup. It's time to light the lights.
It's always been time for that.
It is always. I loved the Muppets.
So did I. So
I liked them more than Star Wars, I have to say that.
Yeah, you were more a Muppet kid, weren't you?
Yeah, I would have loved to see the Muppets do Star Wars. I don't know if
I'm sure there's something on YouTube that's doing that.
They
must be. There's everything
Joe
on YouTube
doing them. But I always thought they were funny, and I used to love the kind of, you know, the guest slots from the Bob Hopes and the Sylvester Stallones and the Judy Covington.
O.J. Simpson.
Yes, O.J. Simpson, all the greats. And now they're back.
They're back, but there has been. It's all over for the Muppets. Yeah. This is it, and this is the nub of the film. That they're 30 years past their heyday. They're the victim of changing fashions. The gang's all disbanded. Kermit's living out in Beverly Hills. Miss Piggy's running Paris Vogue, is it?
Yes, it is.
And Fozzie Bear is operating with a Muppet tribute band.
Yeah, in Reno.
In Reno.
Yeah.
And their old theatre, the beloved old theatre, is about to be bulldozed by Chris Cooper, who's playing a sort of an evil oil man called Tex Richmond.
Yeah.
Just so we, you know, really get the message.
That's great.
And from there, so there's this paradoxical thing. With films where there's almost no plot, I find myself telling the plot in inordinate detail.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we have the case where Jason Segel and Amy Adams, who are real-life humans, who are Muppet fans, galvanise the Muppets, and they put on a benefit gig to raise the money to save the old theatre.
You say they're real-life humans.
They're real-life
humans.
But
they have. Jason Segel has, in what I think is perhaps the most bizarre flourish from a kid's film, he has a Muppet brother.
He does, Walter.
Who he grows up with. And this child is an actual Muppet. I mean, he's a cloth.
And this is the cue for one of the great songs in the film, Man or Muppet.
Man or Muppet.
Which Jason Segel and Walter sing together. If I'm a Muppet, I'm a very manly Muppet, and so it goes.
I'm a Muppet of a man.
It's kind of good, and the whole film is kind of adorable.
It's kind of, it is, and it keeps referring to the fact that it's, you know, that it's a film. And they kind of, when they do the rounding up of all the Muppets and they're all in different places, they, someone stops and sort of says, well, can we just get through this next bit by doing a montage? Yeah. And then they kind of round them all
up.
Yeah,
which makes it sound like sort of very pastiche and postmodern and things like that, which it is. But I think it is made with like real kind of love and affection, and there's a great warmth and, dare I say, a humanity to it. It's you know what this is like? This is like the artist. This is like the artist. It's something old and antiquated that we thought was forgotten, finding it again and dusting it down and realising that it's still beautiful. And yet the artist is nominated for all these Oscars. Nothing for the Muppets.
No, it's not true. Original song.
Original song. Yeah. Okay, well, let's hope it gets that at
least. Yeah, I think it will get that.
That Madonna doesn't steal it.
No, exactly. I thought it was very funny. I mean, it was bits where it just did sort of slightly sag, and you were thinking, well, get on with it.
Like the Muppets.
Yeah, they do. Oh, cloth baggy bagpuss. Yeah. Cat. Chris Cooper does a rap in this.
Yeah, I think that's the first one he's done since Adaptation.
I thought it was funny. The chickens doing CeeLo Green. I mean, I just thought it was funny. My poor Kermit going, my green is feeling grey. Even frogs have rainy days.
Yeah, poor old Kermit.
Yeah,
Kermit. And he's confused at one stage for a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, which again is weird because a kid says, aren't you one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? You think, well, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, they're about 20 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
So the film's reference is a little out at times.
I feel another reboot coming on. Oh, dear. That's The Muppets, which I want to do a summer
really
dancer, but we really enjoyed it. We would. We're not
Film
like,
of the week,
I
maybe.
Thought we were Stadler and Waldorf going to be sitting there going, oh, I can't believe this. But we're not. That's The Muppets. Zan, thank you very much indeed. Zan Brooks, back in the pod for all of Zan's musings about film. Go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Please don't go to Eel Marsh House.
I have to.
I wish you didn't have to go.
The sooner the house is sorted out and sold, the sooner people can move on.
There was no need for you to make the journey.
I don't expect to be finished until Friday.
It's not possible.
I saw a woman.
I can assure you no one goes there.
Whenever she's been seen, something horrible happens.
You don't believe in superstition.
That's the sound of The Woman in Black, and I'm delighted to say that that film's director, James Watkins, joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Film Weekly, James. Congratulations on The Woman in Black. A great follow-up to Eden Lake, kind of a social realist horror. This one goes back into a bit more gothic, this one for you.
Absolutely. This one's much more old school, I suppose. And it was very interesting talking about horror films a lot recently and seeing how audiences have really responded to this film. And there's been so many horror films recently that have been very gory, very nasty. You know, Eden Lake's a nasty film.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of slasher films, and it's very interesting that gory and nasty isn't necessarily the same as scary. And I think what we've tried to do is to make something that's scary by sort of playing on the imagination and indirection.
Yeah. Is that your thing? Is horror your thing? I mean, you obviously start as a British director, you do Eden Lake, and it's like Kelly Riley running around in, which is great, in a wet bra away from lots of hoodies. And it was scary Fassbender as well before he was as big as he is now. Well done, you getting him. And then you get to do this one, which is, you know, it's another horror. Is that what you grew up on? Or are you going to tell me, no, actually, you're a Woody Allen fan?
I love all sorts of films. I mean, I love comedies. I saw A Separation the other night. I thought it was a lovely film. You know, so I've got really broad tastes, but and I'm not particularly seeing myself particularly as like a horror guy. I'm not led by genre. I'm led by story. So if I see a story that I respond to, then that's what I try to get involved with.
Right. And was
I read
this
Jane's
the one?
Script,
did you respond to the novel or Jane Goldman's?
No,
script?
They sent me Jane's script, and I love the script. And I thought there was a potential to make a really, hopefully, a kind of classy, elevated horror ghost story.
Yeah.
That was going to be at one point really scary, but at the other times it had a sort of a heartbeat to it. It had an emotional pull, and it had more ambition, you know, in terms of the sadness and
but
the
it's
loss.
But also we can't forget that it's a Hammer film. You're sort of resurrecting that great label, that British label set. And there's also kind of homage to that kind of gothic, slightly cheesy horror that they've done, and you've wheedled that in as well.
There's definitely a sense in which it's got Hammer on the front of the film, and you're absolutely referencing some of those films in some way. Yeah.
Did you kind of gen up on all the Hammers? Did you have a big Hammer night?
Hammer time. A long night. There's a Hammer time. Yeah. There's a lot of. It's funny. There's some of those early Terence Fisher films, and the early sort of Technicolor Hammer films are great. There's also some Hammer films that are really not so great in the 70s when they slightly hit the skids and they've gone into the sort of lesbian vampire films.
Yeah. I don't know, what's your problem with those?
No, some of them were right. You know? So yeah, look, we definitely wanted to be sort of playing a tradition of the British ghost story, not just Hammer, but you look at films like The Innocents, you know, you look at The Haunting, and then some of the, you know, the Spaniards recently having.
Well,
done...
that's, I was saying to Zan before you came in that it was quite nice to see Britain reclaim that back, because the Spaniards really have got the S horror. We had J horror like in the 2000s, and then the Spaniards with Guillermo del Toro.
Now we can have E horror.
Yeah, now it's English. Hmm. So yes,
you know, it's absolutely. I mean, the ghost story is a very British thing, you know, and so it hadn't really been done in this country for a long time. If you try and think of the real last classic British haunted house story, I mean, you're going back a long, long time. Yeah. So I thought, absolutely, why should the Spaniards
have
all the fun?
The Others or something like that.
Yeah, but that was made by a Spaniard.
Made by a Spaniard, yeah. And set in Jersey.
Set in Jersey, yeah. Shot in Granada or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. What I liked about it was that you've got, obviously, Daniel Radcliffe in there. You can't really ignore his iconography, can you? I mean, it's Harry Potter in a ghost story. What came first? The story, they found Daniel something to do? What's the genesis of it? And then when you suddenly realise that you've got to deal with this iconography as a director?
Yeah, you have to be very mindful. You don't have an actor that's been in the most successful film franchise of all time for 10 years for people not to have associations with him. You know, some people have fantastic associations and some people don't. You know, you can't be that successful without people having an opinion. Well, firstly, what happened was, you know, we talked about Dan and I met with Dan. And once you've met with somebody, it's much easier to break through, you know, preconceptions and misconceptions that people have. Dan is a very, very smart guy. We talked about the script. We talked about the character. He was very intelligent in his responses. He's very committed, and he wants to be challenged. He wants to challenge himself and be challenged. If you just see what he's just done in Broadway for a year.
Did you go to Broadway?
I went and saw it. It was amazing. I mean, he was singing and dancing. And, you know, this was a guy that did not have that training, and he'd spent 2 years, even when he was on our film, he was skipping for 45 minutes every day and having singing lessons and all sorts. And having talked with him about the character, I thought, look, this is a journey that we can go on. I'm prepared. You know, and we screen-tested Dan. We wanted to create a different look to him, you know, completely, you know, take away all the trappings of Harry Potter and really see...
Just lose the glasses.
Well, that helps. Doesn't he? He's got these fantastic blue eyes as well. And, you know, that
and against
his pale skin.
Sort of like,
he's got pale skin. We darkened his hair. So it was all, you know, he's got these great kind of Victorian clothes. So it's trying to create a new look for him, because you need to absolutely have a very strong graphic image to counter what's gone on before. But also in terms of his performance, it's trying to push him and him to push himself in different directions so that... I wanted a much more sort of understated, withheld performance in a slightly different register, because it, you know, it suits the film.
Yeah, well, I thought you got it from him as
Thank
well.
You.
I thought I was impressed with him and that he can do other stuff other than Harry Potter.
Absolutely,
obviously.
And he really did his prep, you know. He went to see grief counsellors, he read lots of Victorian literature on grief and worked really hard in order to embody that character. You know?
Tell me about the places that you did shoot it, because, I mean, you found Eel Marsh Island. I mean, extraordinary place. I refer to it sort of as a Scooby-Doo castle in a way. Yeah. I mean, you just wouldn't go there, this kind of you know, place that is cut off by the tides. Where did you shoot that?
Well, it's the island, the causeway itself is in Essex. It's Ocey Island in Essex. And it was a really tricky place to shoot because it's tidal. Much like in the film, actually in real life, the water comes up through the mud incredibly quickly, and it'll be over your head in about 10 minutes. Mm. And we had you've got a crew of 90 people or whatever it is, and you can only shoot for 4 hours a day, so that's a nightmare for a start because you don't maximise your shooting day. So it was a bit of a fight to say, look, I want to shoot in this location because it's got fantastic production value, knowing that you're going to get impacted upon your shooting day.
So your crew are at risk of being swept
away
by the tide.
Well, they're not really at risk, but they've got to be mindful. It's a bit of a headache for the first ADs, you know, because they have to, you know, the health and safety things that you have on a film. They're constantly saying, right, we've got to move. And you're always constantly pushing and saying, oh, well, come on, we'll just get another shot.
Yeah.
And finally, suddenly
the camera's going down, going into the
eaves. Absolutely. No. So we went there, and then the house itself is in Peterborough. It's a different location. And actually, it's a rather lovely house. And we came in and trashed it.
They must have been gutted with you. So you've got the cobwebs out.
Yeah, we totally. They had this beautiful manicured lawn, and we came in with all our groundsmen and planted all the weeds, and as you do.
You know. Have you put it back exactly the way you found it?
Well, I never do.
They always
I
say
left
you
before
they say the concept of the Gothic horror. I mean, I kind of hold it very dear. I haven't read the original novel, as I confessed earlier. But, you know, the faces in the windows, that hollowed-eyed children, all of that. You had real children getting them all made up, isn't it? I always thought, God, those children must kind of look in the mirror and think, oh, my God, I look really scary. Are they actually freaked out by some of these things?
I think they kind of enjoy it. I mean, it's a funny thing. When you're doing something that's in any way involved with sort of darker material, I think the attitude on set is always quite light and you're trying to make it fun and relaxed. And we had fantastic, you know, Dan's good fun and Kieran Hines and Janet McTeer are really good fun as well. So you've got, you know, you've got an, I kind of quite like a relaxed film set. And for the kids, it's just playing, you know, it's, that's what it is, making movies really. So no, it was good.
They didn't, they might, have they seen it now, the kids? Are they allowed
I'm
to
not
some
sure
of them
all of them are allowed to have seen it because of the rating.
It's 15, right?
No, it's a 12A.
It's a 12A, is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it plays quite scary.
Yeah, I mean, I jumped. Yeah. You know,
absolutely. But there's no violence, there's no gore, there's no nudity, no swearing. So that's probably why the rating.
And were you always going, because you've got a Daniel audience, you're going to go?
I wasn't even thinking about the rating, to be honest. I was just thinking, okay, how can I make a really scary movie? And how can I tell the story to the best of my ability?
Yeah, absolutely. And it taps into, I mean, it's great in the Gothic, it taps into the fears of, about, you know, someone stealing your kids. You know, that is the, I suppose it's a primal fear that goes through the slasher genre, but thriller genres as well.
Absolutely. I think all the best horror films tap into really primal fears. And what's a bigger fear than someone taking away your children? So, but also there's all those other primal fears in terms of, you know, fear of ghosts, fear of shadows, fear of the dark, fear of the unknown, fear of that space between life and death, whatever that might be. So absolutely, you can play, we work quite hard to play on the imagination in terms of those sorts of things, you know, in terms of the really sort of high contrast, light, bright and dark, chiaroscuro lighting. So, you know, the real depth in the image. So you're always constantly looking deep into corridors, you know, and you're not quite sure what's there, what isn't. And actually, there are a few occasions in the film where the woman in black is actually there and you're not aware of it. So we sort of had this kind of Easter egg, you know, constantly trying to put... So you want that sense of, is somebody there, isn't it? Looking in mirrors, looking
Easter
through...
Easter eggs is film jargon for, like, red herring-y type things.
Well, just sort of the sense, you know, like they have on DVDs or something, where you something that you can't quite find it, you know, sometimes.
That's what I'd explain for those Sorry. People. You know, you've talked about ADs before. That's assistant director. That's just
the assistant director.
On this show.
Sorry.
I know, listeners, but you get everything.
This is a film called podcast, isn't
it's
it?
True. They know educated. What they're talking about. This is exactly why we had you on, James. It was a hit in the States. I mean, a big opening.
Yeah, we've had a very good opening in the States. It's been fantastic. So fingers crossed for the UK.
And does that impact on you now as a filmmaker? It's a success. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I think the reviews are going to be fine. You didn't drop the ball. You didn't muck it up. Well done.
Thank you.
What happens next now? Are people just going to give you loads of Gothic horrors to do?
Well, I've done one, so you sort of don't want to repeat yourself.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, just tell that to Peter Cushing.
Yeah, no. That's true. Poor old Peter Cushing. He's a brilliant actor. And yeah,
it's Christopher Lee as well.
Christopher Lee, I think, is absolutely... No, look, I mean, hopefully it doesn't hurt to have a film, hopefully, that does well.
Yeah.
And it's all about people giving you money for the next one. So I'm not about to do a romantic comedy, but I've sort of, you know, I've made a couple of sort of horror films. They're both very different horror films.
But they both involve children in a way, and children, some have gone to the bad and some good is. I wonder if
one's fear of children and one's sort of fear for children in many ways. But I mean, that's a pure coincidence, I think. I don't know what
you know. You always say this, you directors, you don't know. You see, it's up to us critics to point out your tropes and recurring themes to you.
That's true. I don't know what's next. I mean, I'd like to do a really good contemporary London thriller.
Brilliant. James Watkins, absolute pleasure to have you on, as usual, on Film Weekly. Congratulations on The Woman in Black.
Thanks, Jess.
And that brings us to an end of this week's Film Weekly. Thanks to my guests Viggo Mortensen and James Watkins, also to Zan Brooks as ever. The music we've been listening to on the show this week is from Casablanca, 70 years old, given a restoration and Blu-ray spruce up, and it's on the big screen as well to celebrate that anniversary. Play it again. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this week's edition of Film Weekly, Ian Chambers, it's goodbye. A case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.